Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. On the afternoon of Friday, October the 7th, the Washington Post released a now infamous tape of Donald Trump bragging about sexually assaulting women back in 2005.
I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. You just kiss. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it.
That evening, WikiLeaks released the first batch of emails hacked from the account of Hillary Clinton's campaign chair, John Podesta. Among them, excerpts of speeches Secretary Clinton made to elite Wall Street financial firms and had refused to disclose to the public.
The Clinton campaign is not saying whether or not the new emails released by WikiLeaks are authentic. They are quoting members of the intelligence community who say that it is possible that whoever hacked into the emails could have altered some of them to make them more damaging.
It is moments like these when newsrooms are forced to choose which story to lead with. In newspaper lingo, which appears top right above the fold and what gets buried on page 6. In other words, what is most newsworthy? That question guides coverage, even on slow news days. But newsworthiness and how it's determined and how shrinking resources and new technology have changed what gets reported and what falls to the wayside— and what goes unreported while election 2016 seems to suck up all the air in the room are some of the questions we're exploring with Ron Elving. He's senior editor and correspondent on the Washington Guest for NPR and a regular on the NPR Politics podcast. Ron, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Virginia.
So we all learn in J school a couple of the pillars of newsworthiness. Did you learn those and how have they changed?
They have changed only in that they have become more intensely skewed towards what gets an audience. Now, that has always been a tremendous concern, even a paramount concern in most media. But for many of the more serious news operations, I'm thinking particularly here about newspapers and magazines, there was also a very strong concern about what people needed to know, what people had to know in order to make their voting choices, and just in general towards a perhaps a little bit superior, a little bit elitist notion of what really was the proper focus. So in the world we're in today, the need to generate audience is so much stronger even than it was 20, 30, 40 years ago that it really does, it seems to me, increasingly obliterate all other considerations. And even in public radio, where we like to think of ourselves as high-minded and culturally oriented, even in public radio, we are increasingly devoted to the idea of maximizing our audience.
Mm-hmm. But let's go back to that October 7th. You know, NPR, of course, and major networks, they have a lot of reporters and editors covering politics, following the Trump and Clinton campaign. So it's not as if they're choosing which story to cover. But one of them has to be the lead for the news magazines. The talk shows are going to pick them up. So if you're looking at that 2005 Trump tape and the Podesta email dump same day, how considered in terms of relative newsworthiness?
We're going to look for what people are going to be talking about. We're going to focus on what people are going to be talking about so as not to seem as though we have somehow been left out of the conversation or are not aware of something that everyone else is obsessing about. So we're going to look, first of all, for a powerful story. We're going to look for something that is relatively new, if not absolutely new. And we're going to look for something that has a strong connective element such as audio or visual material, a picture, some videotape, some audio tape. And even in radio, we're really looking for that tape. We really want to enable people to visualize something by giving them the audio prompt. And I would say that this Donald Trump tape on October 7th that would came, of course, from NBC in 2005, had a very strong visual element to it, whether you were watching it or not. And that made it a more powerful story. That is not to say that the WikiLeaks story was not important or that it was on another level of importance, but only to say that what we are going to do in the news media, in the media in general, is we're going to try to connect with an audience.
But in the WikiLeaks story, there were several headlines that had something akin to, you know, email dump from WikiLeaks, yawn, you know, as if it wasn't an interesting story. It wasn't going to be talked about. And I did notice on the NPR newscast that day and the following weekend, They seem to make absolutely certain that if there were a headline on the Trump tape, it would be followed each time by the WikiLeaks dump. Now, is there this idea that they are equal stories, or there is somehow fairness in representing both of them in the same headline?
That idea does bounce around. We talk about it a lot. We talk about balance and fairness. We talk about representing both perspectives. We talk about being fair to all sides of any controversy, and particularly to both sides of a binary political struggle. Now, one could raise the question of whether we're being fair to the Gary Johnson campaign and the Jill Stein campaign, which we certainly do not spend nearly as much time with. But at least we try to make an effort between the two major parties. And that's a habit, I think, all of us in the news media have gotten into over the years. We have fallen into the major party habit. That is the way we organize most of our coverage, and that is a whole separate area of criticism. But as far as the WikiLeaks story, which we have followed and which continues with the revelations about Bill Clinton Inc., in close quotes, and the amount of money that he was making, in a sense, on the side while running the Clinton Foundation as the former president, those stories, the big ones, have gotten a great deal of attention and have been front and center. But many of the WikiLeaks stories have essentially been walking through the trash basket of the Clinton campaign or pre-campaign period, when people who were going to be working for her were going back and forth about how her campaign should be handling various controversies.
We're speaking with Ron Elving. He's senior editor and correspondent at the Washington News Desk for NPR and also a regular on the NPR Politics podcast. We're talking about the concept of newsworthiness and how it has played out or how it's evolved during election 2016. Joining us now is Roy Peter Clark. He's vice president and senior scholar at Poynter. And Roy, thank you for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Social media has given the public a leading role in deciding or shaping editorial. They share and thereby elevate stories that people want to share on social media. They float into the internet equivalent of the front page. How is that changing ideas, Roy, about what is and what is not newsworthy?
Well, when I teach the idea of newsworthiness, I kind of find myself in a kind of a vice. On one side, I feel that the ability to have a good news judgment requires experience. Newsworthiness has two components. Something is interesting, or it's important, or on the best news days, it's both interesting and important. I think the problem that we're seeing in this election is that things which are merely interesting have been magnified to a level of importance because, of course, it's a presidential campaign.
But how about social media that becomes, in a way, a newsmaker? I'm thinking, for example, Ken Bone, you know, the man in the red sweater who became an internet meme. And I think people seized upon him because he looked like a regular, everyday nice guy, a kind of salve, you know, an intense debate. This was during the second presidential debate. Follow-up by Gizmodo dug into his online porn searches and a little bit on his legal history. So this was a person who became news in some way in the social media realm. Would NPR or the New York Times had appeared flat-footed if they didn't talk about Ken Bone? I'm going to put that to you, Ron.
This is the conversation that I was speaking of before, the political discourse that spreads out to include all kinds of people like Ken Bone, who suddenly became, as you say, a meme. He became something that we all needed to know a little something about in order to tell our audience that that these people they were turning to in the media had something to say about what they cared about or what was new, what was happening. I think some of that is the bright, shiny object that pulls us away from what we should be focused on. It's a distraction. It's adult attention deficit syndrome. And we should resist it as much as we possibly can. And perhaps mention Ken Bone, perhaps mention the sorrows that his sudden fame may have caused him, but move on. Move on as quickly as possible and relegate those things to the margins of our coverage.
Melvin Mencher, the famous journalism teacher, you know, has a list of elements that sort of attach themselves to events and make them more or less newsworthy. Things like time, location, impact, conflict, currency, prominence. and this wide open category that he calls the bizarre. I think that social media has magnified certain elements, such as the bizarre, such as prominence, such as conflict and currency, but at the same time, it's kind of minimized other aspects, such as location, for example. And I think that also has a tendency to magnify what has been called a sort of echo chamber effect. We learn more and more news from our friends, you know, and that has certain benefits, and it has certain problems associated that we're seeing magnified in this news cycle.
Well, it has been noted, especially early in the campaign, that media outlets were so fascinated by Trump's sort of irreverent, unprecedented statements that he got an enormous amount of airtime. This is something his Republican competitors complained about, and many news consumers have also noted or mentioned. So the more outrageous his statements, the more free airtime he got. The attention itself made him newsworthy. What do you say to that?
So the classic slogan about news, you know, involves the man and the dog. Who bites whom? And so that's meant to demonstrate extraordinariness rather than representativeness. Signals a kind of an attention that leads to coverage. And I just think we have to look at the Trump campaign as so eccentric. I mean that in a literal sense, right? Out of the center. So unusual that it had a number of effects. The first was just to throw the routines of conventional journalism sort of out of whack. The gyroscope just started to wobble. And it also probably led to kinds of coverage we've never seen before. I think if we did a when it's all said and done, we do a content analysis and we look back on this, we'll look at all the important issues that do affect Americans in real ways and really see how either superficial or cliched the coverage of those issues were, with a few really significant exceptions, including public radio, I must say.
And that is where our coverage is going to end. Roy Peter Clark, Vice President and Senior Scholar at Poynter, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
And Ron Elving, NPR Senior Editor and Correspondent, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
You can find loads more on NPR's coverage and Poynter's analysis of the election. Links are at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And you can hear Ron on the NPR Politics podcast, which is airing daily until Election Day.